I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Richard Michelson, poet, award-winning children's book writer, and the author of the new volume of verse, Sleeping as Fast as I Can. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. A wonderful man passed away recently, Rabbi Harold Kushner, a blessed memory, best known as the writer of the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Harold Kushner was a congregational rabbi, author on many important Jewish and human subjects, a three-time guest of Too Jewish, and a warm, kind, and truly special person. I had the privilege of having him speak from the pulpit of my synagogue several times and got to know him during those visits. Although his books sold millions of copies and he influenced many people for good, when you met him, he had the remarkable ability to make you feel that you were the most important person in the world at that moment. He always asked about your life and your family, rather than telling you about his own accomplishments, as most of us seem to do. I first read When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Remember, it's when bad things happen to good people, not why. When I was a cantor in Los Angeles in the early 1980s. Its story, with Harold Kushner sharing the tale of the degenerative illness and early death of his teenage son, is sad and deeply touching. And Kushner's incredible humanity emerges from every page of that book. I don't know that I necessarily have to agree with his thesis that God is inherently limited and can only do so much. But I know that he helped more people with his gentle, thoughtful, inspiring words than most of us rabbis could hope to reach if we had many lifetimes. I've given out his book to so many grieving people over my years as cantor and rabbi, and 42 years after it was published, I still think When Bad Things Happen to Good People is the best book to give somebody who is suffering the pain of profound loss. It brings help and hope when that is most desperately needed. It is a gift, as was he. Harold Kushner went on to write many more books, including When All You Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, Overcoming Life's Disappointments, Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World, and L'Chaim, To Life, a celebration of Jewish being and thinking. In the face of life's challenges, Harold Kushner was an optimist with a gentle sense of humor and a grace and innate decency, and he lived that way in every area of his life. Kushner gave us so much, and his work will continue to do so. His memory can bring only blessing. To play us in this morning here on Too Jewish, it's a lovely Sephardic song, the classic Morenika, sung by Nani.
Morenika mi mejaman, roblanka nasi. Graciosica sos, tu morena y yo gracioso y ojos pretos tú.
Morenica mi me
morenica, graciosica sos, tu morena y yo gracioso, y ojos pretos tú.
Our guest on Too Jewish this morning, Richard Michelson, is a poet, an award-winning children's book author, and a prominent gallery owner. His new book, Sleeping as Fast as I Can, is a wonderful collection of his latest poems, including some very Jewish verses indeed, and some very funny ones. Meet Richard Michelson when he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish, I don't want to say an old friend, a friend of long standing, Richard Michelson, a wonderful poet, an author of children's books, really a multi-talent who's had a gallery, a wonderful gallery for a long time. His new book is called Sleeping as Fast as I Can, a new book of poetry. He has received a National Jewish Book Award, two Sidney Taylor Gold Medals from the Association of Jewish Library for his children's books, and served as the Poet Laureate of Northampton, Massachusetts. Good morning and welcome, Richard.
Good morning. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you again.
I have to say, I really enjoyed this new volume, and I'm going to jump right in because, in particular, I like Jewish. It's a very Jewish book, but I particularly like the Pesach poems. Can you tell us about the origins of those?
Sure. Well, it is probably my most, shall we say, my most Jewish collection of poetry.
Not too Jewish, though, of course.
It skirts there. you can't be too Jewish. But a couple of things. The fourth section, you know, this book is really into four different sections. The first one is primarily has to do with Jewish history and today's politics. Then we have a section about my mom's descent into Alzheimer's and death, my dad's death. But the fourth section of the book is really a re-envisioning of the Passover Haggadah. I'm sorry that the book came out literally a week after Passover, so I didn't get to do the Passover reading tour. I'll have to do that next year. But it started in a few ways. There's a brand new anthology out that's called New Voices, and it actually came out by happenstance on the same day that my book came out, which also by happenstance was Yom HaShoah.
Wow.
And New Voices is an anthology of contemporary poets on the Holocaust, but it's different than most anthologies. They contacted a bunch of poets and gave us each a visual, which is included in the anthology, of various Holocaust imagery. and asked us to write to that. I got a picture of Eichmann's trial and the people who were watching, and kind of a jury. And I wrote a poem for that about based on Passover, and about really the it's called Prayer Before the Eating of the Koresh, and it's about the Passover sandwich, and it's also about how we stand between, say, as the last line says, the angel of all we will never know and the angel of all we must never forget. And that was, this was a few years ago, that kind of kicked things off. I also started, you know, every time I read the Gada every year, there are things I want to say to some of the poems that we read. And I wonder, for myself, I wonder if I would have had the courage to follow the Jews into the sea, that it was going to part. And I wondered about those people who didn't have the courage and might have just stood on the shore watching. And that led to other things, you know, the dipping of the herbs, the washing of the hands, and my thoughts about it. And the more I wrote, it just...
became a whole sequence, didn't it? Yeah.
In a sense, I was following the order, the Passover order, and trying to give my own take on some of the things that we have been celebrating for millennials and millennials.
Is it all right if I read that prayer before the parting of the sea?
You're welcome to.
Let us praise those abandoned on the shore, unsure of the trick of their eyes, but knowing in their hearts that the waters will refuse to part. They are standing there still, calculating tides and measuring mud flats, their flow charts and bridges deserving no lesser suspension of disbelief. May we watch our brethren pass over daily, their encouragements drowned in the sound of the armies descending upon us. Death's certainty, too, is a kind of miracle.
Oh, that was lovely to hear in your voice. Thank you.
Well, no,
it's... You'll have to come on a reading tour with me.
I'm happy to. You know, I don't charge that much. we will return in just a few moments with Richard Michelson. His new book is called Sleeping as Fast as I Can, Poems. He's also a wonderful children's book author, gallery owner, a multi-talent. Let's call him a man of letters and images. When we spend more time with Richard Michelson, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area. Weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us at Beit Simcha in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to find out more. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-aged children and grandchildren, fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha, Tucson.org. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events open to everyone. Friday night, services are at 6:30 p.m., followed by an Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m. in person or on Zoom. All of our services are on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our Adult Education Academy classes are available live and on Zoom, including a number of Kabbalah and other classes. email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, send your kid or grandkid to religious school or Torah Tikes, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Please join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean, and now on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you are a kind of expert in the Balkans, I would say. I don't know, an adopted son, kind of. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, so as you know, I just made a trip to that part of the world. And although technically it's not in the Balkans, Vienna in some ways is the capital of the Balkans.
Well, because they controlled it for a long time.
Well, they controlled a lot of the Balkans, and the Ottoman Empire controlled the rest. And the frontier between the two empires crossed back and forth across the Balkans, and specifically across the former Yugoslavia, which no longer exists as one entity, although they all have fond memories of good old days.
The good old days under Tito, huh?
Okay. Right. So, you know, I hardly know where to begin because this trip was so rich in impressions, both Jewish and just general cultural impressions. But I think I'll start with the most specifically Jewish focus of this trip, which was spending Friday night at the home/synagogue of the chief rabbi of Montenegro.
Who's your friend, about whom you've spoken many times, I think.
Whose installation I coincidentally attended like 5 or 6 years ago. And at that point, there were officially zero Jews in Montenegro and no like registered organized Jewish communities at all. And this rabbi, with whom I'm on a first name basis, so let's just call him Ari for purposes of the show, has built up a network of about a dozen communities. And one of them is large enough on the coast to have another rabbi, an active synagogue, and a kosher restaurant, which we don't even have here in Tucson.
We do not.
So this guy's been a huge success. There were probably a dozen different communities in Montenegro that held community seders this year for Passover. The supplies came from Israel via Chabad. And I was lucky enough to be invited to his home for Friday night services and dinner, which were basically, we had services outdoors because the weather was mild. And we went indoors to a dining room, which also doubles as a synagogue because there's an Aron Kodesh with two Sifrei Torah in it. And what was really interesting for me was the composition of the guests around the table. There were approximately 25 or 30 people. A fair number were from Israel. Some were just traveling, like young couples who wanted a free dinner or were not particularly religious, but wanted to be with other Jews on Friday night, because even secular Israelis treat Friday night as something special, as you know.
They do indeed.
And there were Jews there from Georgia, from Russia, from Albania, from France, and from the United States. And it turns out I was showing a guy around on this whole trip, which included Vienna, several places in Montenegro, and Thessaloniki, which we'll get to in a minute. But turns out that his wife is married to the Chabad rabbi in Venice, and they run the kosher restaurant in Venice.
I've been there for Chabad.
Right. Actually. So, basically, this guy who grew up Reform and was not particularly comfortable in this very Hasidic setting is, through his wife at least, closely related to another Chabad rabbi, which was a very funny coincidence. Anyway, the evening basically used all of my language abilities, and I realized that the one I'm most rusty in is Russian because I speak it less, but all the other ones I'm pretty comfortable in, and it was a very pleasant and inspirational evening, and we'll get to some other aspects of the trip, I hope, next week.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Only today, for you, we have two Jewish proverbs. One of life's greatest mysteries is that somehow the boy who wasn't good enough to marry your daughter became the father of the smartest grandchild in the entire world. And my Jewish mother doesn't just enjoy guilt trips. She runs the whole travel agency. Those were the old Jewish jokes of the week. Well, today, actually, two old Jewish proverbs. A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. Superficially, this new book with its English name Numbers is just a listing of, well, names and numbers. Not a very interesting text for study or inspiration. But it teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes, too. The notion that everybody counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that you must have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan, to the requirement that we must view every other person as a Tzelem Elohim, an image of God, no different from ourselves in value or holiness. The Talmud tells us that one person who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved an entire world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. When we do the tabulation that lets us know we have the 10 people required for a minyan, traditionally, we don't count by numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever, since that would devalue every human being into being a mere, well, digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words, and we work our way through it until we have completed the passage, thus making sure that every member of that accounting is part of a holy sentence. In a world of numbers, many of them grim, it's comforting to realize that we are each more than the sum of our parts. No matter how quantified and digitized our lives can become, we human beings each matter to God, to each other, and to this world. Now, the Hebrew name for this portion and this book is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. The name comes from the first words of the book, but it also has greater resonance and meaning than simply that. Every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems, we must head out into the desert. It was true of Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar Sinai, seeking God and revelation. Why do we have to head out into the nothingness of desert to find truth? Well, maybe it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complication and complexity, most of which truly are unimportant. But until we leave behind the conveniences of home, until we divest ourselves of comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert. There's nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is, coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenants. You too can find God in the wilderness. That is just as true in the Sonoran Desert as it was in the Sinai Desert. We simply need to look for God, away from the complications of our daily lives. The poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice?" The answer is yes. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Richard Michelson, art gallery owner, children's book author, multiple guest on Too Jewish, and perhaps above all, a poet, tells us what makes his new book so, but not too Jewish. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Terrorist killed five people in an attack on an ancient synagogue on the island of Djerba, Tunisia, during an annual pilgrimage for Lag BaOmer that attracts thousands of Jews and is a rare instance of Jewish partnership with an Arab nation. Two of the dead were Jewish cousins who had traveled to Djerba from France and Israel, respectively, for festivities at the El Griba synagogue. Aviel Haddad, 30 years old, was a Tunisian citizen living in Netivot, Israel. Benjamin Haddad, 42, lived in France. The other three dead were Tunisian security officials. The murderer was also a Tunisian security guard killed by security officials. Tunisia's TAP news agency said a number of other people were wounded, some seriously. The attack took place at the end of an evening of festivities at El Griba, a place for Jewish worship that dates back 2,500 years in Tunisia. It is also a central attraction of the pilgrimage each year on or around Lag BaOmer, a break during the 49 days of minor mourning between Pesach and Shavuot. This pilgrimage mostly attracts people with ties to Tunisia's historic Jewish community. But this year, the Lag BaOmer pilgrimage launched the day before the attack in a ceremony attended by Deborah Lipstadt, U.S. envoy monitoring anti-Semitism, alongside the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia, Joey Hood, and Tunisian officials. "I am sickened and heartbroken by the lethal anti-Semitic attack targeting the Griba Synagogue in Djerba during Lag BaOmer's celebrations. Thousands of Jewish pilgrims in attendance," said Lipstadt, a past guest of Too Jewish. The pilgrimage has grown substantially in recent years after trepidation following an attack on El Griba by Al-Qaeda in 2002 that killed 21 and a suspension a decade ago amid security concerns. The Tunisian government has invested in the pilgrimage, billing it as a symbol of the country's tolerance and provided intense security. Now the revelation that one of those security officers appears to have orchestrated the attack on the Jewish pilgrims has undercut those efforts. "I think it's a death blow for the foreseeable future to a beautiful tradition and pilgrimage. It is causing palpable pain," said Avi Chana, a French-Israeli Jew born in Tunisia who participated. About 1,000 Jews live in Tunisia, one of the only continuing Jewish communities in the Arab world. That is, it has never had a break since 2,500 years ago. Most of Tunisia's Jewish population, estimated over 100,000 prior to 1948, left the country for Israel or France by 1970. The island of Djerba is famous as a home to a number of Sofrim, scribes, who write Torah scrolls. It has a remarkable Jewish history of scholarship and trade. This Lag BaOmer pilgrimage is a unique aspect of its tradition. It is tragic to see it marred, perhaps even destroyed, by an act of anti-Semitic terrorism. In Israel, fighting in the Gaza Strip between Israel and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad terror group is ongoing, following days of deadly Israeli airstrikes and more than 400 Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel. Last week, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said, "I hope we will bring it to an end soon, but we are ready for it to be protracted." Israel's airstrikes have killed 21 Palestinians and wounded 40. Those killed were senior members of Islamic Jihad and at least 9 civilians. No Israelis have been reported killed or wounded by the more than 400 rockets fired by Palestinians from Gaza to date, although 8 Israelis have been treated for injuries while leaving for shelter. The Israeli military named the offensive Shield and Arrow. I guess that's Magen V'Keshet, I'm not sure. That would be bow. Anyway, Hamas, the terrorist group that controls the Gaza Strip, has claimed involvement in the Gaza rocket fire alongside attacks by Islamic Jihad. But Israeli officials believe it's Islamic Jihad and question the claim by Hamas. Israel has instituted emergency measures in towns near the Gaza border, evacuating thousands of residents. Its defense systems, including Iron Dome and a new interceptor called David Sling, have felled dozens of rockets since the attacks began.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
Filmmaker Christopher Nolan is releasing a new movie this summer called Oppenheimer, dramatizing the race to create the first nuclear bomb in the midst of World War II. From the previews and Nolan's past filmography of dramatic hits, Oppenheimer looks like an excellent film. Of course, there were many prominent Jewish scientists, especially physicists, central to the atomic bomb that ended the war. In addition to J. Robert Oppenheimer, the leading figure in the film and head of the scientific effort of the Manhattan Project. Among the leading Jewish scientists involved were, at the beginning, Albert Einstein, whose famous letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt helped move the project into operation. U.S. Atomic Energy Commission Chair Louis Strauss, Manhattan Project physicist Richard Feynman, hydrogen bomb developer Edward Teller, and nuclear physicist Isidore Isaac Rabi. Interestingly, in the Oppenheimer movie, only Teller and Rabi are played by Jewish actors. Everybody else, no matter how well portrayed, is played by a non-Jewish actor. Well, here on Too Jewish, I've avoided discussing the so-called Jew-facing that has been ongoing in Hollywood for some years, in spite of the fact that Jews, well, invented the movie business, and to a large degree, television, too. For years, decades, there were very few obviously Jewish characters, films, or TV shows available on American screens. When one did appear, miraculously, we embraced it immediately as manna from show business heaven. That was true of all 3 versions of the jazz singer, of course, or Fiddler on the Roof, or Yentl, or even lesser offerings like The Prince of Egypt or Keeping the Faith. They ended up being shown at every self-respecting synagogue and JCC eventually. Then we had the endless run of Holocaust films, still ongoing, Schindler's List most prominent among them. There were TV shows with clearly Jewish-seeming characters, Seinfeld, of course, helmed by Jewish comedian Jerry Seinfeld and the also-Jewish actor sidekick Jason Alexander, although really it had no official Jewish content, just a New York City vibe that was very recognizably Jewish. So generally speaking, while there were many Jewish studio heads, actors, directors, producers, and certainly writers, there weren't a whole lot of recognizably Jewish shows or characters. Ah, but something changed dramatically about a decade ago. Maybe more, 15 years ago. Suddenly it became acceptable to create Jewish films and TV shows with not only Jewish flavor and humorous sensibility, but actual Jewish themes and plot lines began to appear. Very Jewish streaming shows became all the rage. Soon every Israeli series of any quality became a hot property in the U.S. video market. And then a funny thing happened on the way to finally mainstreaming Jewish characters and Jewish plot lines. Non-Jews seem to be playing most of the best Jewish roles. In the wake of the runaway success a couple of years ago of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, whose titular Jewish comedian lead is played by Rachel Brosnahan, a past guest of Too Jewish and a wonderful actress, but neither a comedian nor Jewish. Jewish comedian and actress Sarah Silverman argued publicly that a new term should be applied to the phenomenon, Jew-facing. You know, like when Tony Shalhoub, an incredible Lebanese-American actor, was cast as the very Jewish father on Mrs. Maisel by its Jewish showrunner, you had to wonder just a little bit if Sarah Silverman was right.
Why are you mad? I didn't do anything wrong.
When I agreed to send you to that fancy Goyish college, what was the one thing I told you?
They'll have terrible deli.
The important thing I told you.
That was about deli, too.
The other important thing I told you.
Don't pick a weak man. This isn't my fault!
Of course it's your fault.
Oh, shit! Mama.
In general, I must admit that there are far more important things to worry about than that the guy playing the lead, J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a movie isn't Jewish. I mean, the writers are on strike in Hollywood now. Lots of them certainly are Jewish. And if that doesn't get resolved soon, we won't even have this issue to argue about for a while. Still, when a big-budget historical biopic with lots of famous figures gets made, and almost all the very Jewish leading figures, Oppenheimer, Einstein, Strauss, Feynman, are played by fine non-Jewish actors, makes you wonder if there is now a shortage of good Jewish actors, which I doubt. It's nice that Benny Safdie and David Krumholtz get smallish roles as the Jewish physicists Edward Teller and Isaac Rabi, but perhaps it's time to wonder why Jews cannot play Jewish lead characters these days. Look, it's not entirely a new phenomenon. I remember watching Once Upon a Time in America about Jewish gangsters, which starred Robert De Niro and James Woods as the leads. Neither of them remotely Jewish. In fact, Italian Catholic and Irish Catholic? I mean, these are actors. They should have the range to play many different sorts of roles. But when even the redoubtable and very Jewish Steven Spielberg, in his own biopic, The Fabelmans, I mean, it's about his own life. Spiel means fable or play, right? Get it? Spielberg? Fableman? Anyway, Spielberg cast mostly non-Jewish actors in all the lead roles, with the exception of Seth Rogen. That is, he cast non-Jewish actors to play his Jewish father and mother and himself. Well, there are certainly more important issues facing American Judaism, but for pity's sake, Hollywood, cast some Jews to play Jews, okay? Hey. And that's the news of Jews round the world. Welcome back to Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Richard Michelson, is a poet, a children's book author of great distinction. His new book is called Sleeping As Fast As I Can Poems. As you said, this is your most Jewish book of poetry. A lot of sadness, you know, around your mother and some of the other aspects of it. Does poetry work better if there's some sadness involved?
Does poetry work better if there's some sadness involved? Well, you know, I think when I'm really happy, I'm out enjoying the world, maybe, rather than
sitting around writing.
Rather than sitting at my desk, I'm in the sunshine or at the beach. But, you know, this book was written over the past 5 or 6 years. I know this is not a political show, but for me, it was difficult years, both publicly. I have always had my anti-Semitic antenna up and always warned my children this or that. But I was very much caught off guard by the spate of anti-Semitic incidents over the last few years, how it's grown, the hate speech. And then personally, my mother was also, as many people I'm sure have the same experience, descending into dementia. And I saw that the person who I knew was no longer the person that I knew, yet I still loved her greatly. And so, you know, I started to think about our personalities and what it is that makes our personalities, to see, not to be able to have conversations with my mother that I used to see her, in a sense, become a child again. But at the same time, she seemed happier than she ever was in her life, which was not a particularly happy life. My dad was a victim of gun violence.
He was murdered.
Spent more than 40 years trying to champion the cause of gun safety, something that I am definitely losing that battle. It seems to get worse and worse. But all these things conspired during the time I was writing. And while the book is certainly darker than my other books, I'm hoping that it still has a sense of humor, sometimes dark humor, but humor is historically the Jews' saving grace. And I couldn't write without that. So, I was watching my mother and trying to figure out who she was. I was watching the country, and I found that going back to the history of Judaism was what gave me courage and hope, because we have overcome so much. Obviously, this book was written as well during the pandemic years. Jews were blamed early on for the Black Plague, for the plague of 1918. We were always accused, oftentimes did better than the general public, which because of the fact that Jews tended to live in close-knit communities, and also because, you just mentioned Passover, they, unlike in the Middle Ages, would clean out their homes once a year. Kasher the homes, dust and leaven. So there's this long history, and it tied in with what we were living today, very much so. So all that kind of wove itself together and came out in this book of poems.
You wrote quite a bit after the Pittsburgh attack, the Tree of Life attack on the synagogue. There's a number of these poems kind of reflect on that and on violence. You always do so with a certain ironic flavor to it. Tell us about those poems.
Well, again, that was an eye-opener for me, as it was for many, the shooting in Pittsburgh. It was not an isolated incident by any means, but it certainly caught the imagination of many people. How do you write about tragedies like that? Certainly you don't want to use other people's tragedies to, there's something about writing tragedies that makes me uncomfortable, because I'm using other people's experience for my own purposes. On the other hand, how can we not address them? We have to address them. We have to get through them. We have to move through them. We can do that with empathy, we can do that with humor, we can do that with understanding, we can do that through politics. We have to face these things. We can't put them under the rugs. And I'm a poet, so the way I face life is through words. And words to me, you know, you could, just the act of writing itself is an optimistic endeavor. If we didn't write, people write both for themselves, but also for future generations. If we didn't think that there were going to be future generations, if we thought things were hopeless, it would be very difficult to put pen to paper. It's why that we can read poems that are even about a death in the family or mass murder. And while you're reading them, they can lift your heart. That's such an interesting thing to me, that we could read a book, say, that most people have read by Elie Wiesel, that is of the darkest subjects. Yet there's pleasure in the writing of it, in the way he's formed his sentences. It's just such an odd thing, and it's something that I also try to explore in my own work, which then becomes self-referential, and that alone has, you know, a certain irony, but it's usually against myself.
So this is a worst question. What's your favorite poem in this collection?
My favorite poem in this collection tends to switch. Every time I do a reading, there's something else that comes out at me. My favorite poems in this book are Neighborhood Villanelle, which is a poem about my own upbringing and my dad's death. I'm also particularly fond of, and I also read it a lot at readings because it's shorter than many of the poems.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. I remember reading Browning's Ring in the Book in college and thinking, you couldn't do this at a reading. It's an entire one long poem.
I'm partial to Angels with Guns Guarding the Gates of Heaven, which is about guns and my own synagogue here in Amherst,
right.
During the debate of whether we start locking doors or leaving them open. I'm also partial to the Sestina. For those in your audience, I'll say very quickly, is most of these poems are written in forms. The more, the more emotional a poem is to me in my own life, I find traditional forms help me. They give me that structure that I need so that I can work through an emotion. A sestina is a traditional poem of six stanzas of six lines each, where the last line repeats in a different order in every stanza. And I have a poem, Vermin, which brings together Einstein, Max Brod, Kafka, who's in many of my poems, Mozart, Hitler, yeah. And Trump's grandfather, all in a stew. So I'm proud of the way that poem worked together. A Neighborhood Villanelle is a poem.
So would you favor us with Neighborhood Villanelle?
Sure. Did you want to read it, or you'd like me to?
You wrote it. I'm happy to read it, but I think you should. This is so personal. I think it really should be you.
This is Neighborhood Villanelle. A villanelle is, again, a formal poem of stanzas, three-line stanzas, where the last line repeats in the following stanza, and that continues what most people are, I think, familiar with, Dylan Thomas, "Do not go gentle into that good night,
rage against the dying of the light." Yeah.
So that's the form. Neighborhood Villanelle. "In this neighborhood, you'd better learn to fight," my father says. "Real schooling's from hard knocks. Books won't save your life." He knows I'd rather write and read. I don't talk back. His love is no birthright. Instead, I bluff, act tough. He teaches me to box. "In this neighborhood, you'd better learn to fight," he says, "or you'll be prey. Better tough Israelite than studious black hat, defenseless orthodox. Books won't save your life. I know you'd rather write." Next day was Hanukkah. the Festival of Lights. Hey, Jew boy, some kids jeered as if I wore earlocks. I was no Maccabee. Bluff called. I could not fight. I came too battered, bruised, but had no appetite for bloodshed or revenge. Instead, I walked for blocks, prayed books would save my life. I swore someday I'd write these lines, and now I have. We never kissed goodnight, yet every poem I wrote, he saved. The paradox, a bullet stopped his life. Lead plug he could not fight. I escape the neighborhood with every word I write.
That's great. I want to thank Richard Michelson, who has definitely escaped the neighborhood. His new book is called Sleeping As Fast As I Can Poems. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your children's books as well, your books
on
poetry?
Thank you. I should say that since I'm speaking to your audience, I probably don't have to explain the title, but most people are familiar with the Yiddish proverb, sleep faster, we need the pillows.
Yes.
If you go to my site, which is richardmichelson.com, Richard, M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-N.com, you can read some poems, you can order some books, you can see my children's books. You can email me, say hello, tell me you heard me on this podcast. I would love to say hello to you. Other than that, your local bookstores, the evil Amazon, that's okay. If you buy it there, leave a review, and that will be your penance. come see me, go to your bookstores, and buy poetry. Because it's
great
for me and my friends.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Merrill Ain, author of the new book, Shadows We Carry. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person, and of course on our Facebook page, Torah Studies on Zoom. Our playout this morning for Mother's Day today, a Hallmark holiday, but still a nice thing to observe, is the classic A Yiddish Imama, sung by Yitzchak Meir Helfgott with the amazing violinist Yitzchak Perlman. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, a happy Mother's Day, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.